From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge, Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion. This hour, Debating Darwin. I'm Jim Fleming. Roughly half of all Americans believe the biblical story of creation, according to a recent Pew poll. Only a quarter believe the theory of evolution. These numbers leave a lot of scientists mystified and, quite frankly, angry. Biologist Richard Dawkins believes the raging debate over evolution points to an even bigger problem.
If you think, as I do, that the war is between supernaturalism and naturalism, between science and religion, then the war over the teaching of evolution is just one skirmish, just one battle in the war.
So, is Darwinian evolution compatible with faith in God? Today we'll hear from Richard Dawkins, as well as creationist Paul Nelson. And what did Darwin himself think? We'll go to Cambridge University in England to get a first-hand look at Darwin's letters. Also, an evolutionary biologist who rejects both biblical creationism and the standard account of evolution.
This argument between science and religion I see as absolutely unnecessary. Let's say the universe is in the business of creating living systems, that it's conscious, and it wouldn't spoil anything in science.
But first, philosopher Daniel Dennett, one of the leading advocates of evolutionary theory and a fierce critic of creationism. In his book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, he makes the case that evolution is like a universal acid, an idea so radical that it eats away everything it touches. Steve Paulson asked Dennett to explain what he means.
The idea of universal acid was the idea of an acid that could eat through anything. So what on earth could you keep it in? You couldn't keep it in glass because it could eat through glass just the way it could eat through a tin can. And then it occurred to me that there's a certain sense in which Darwinism is an idea like that, that really does turn everything upside down. Before Darwin, we had the idea, and people still have it, of course, that it takes a big, fancy, smart thing to make a less intelligent thing. You never see a pot making a potter. You never see a horseshoe making a blacksmith. And along comes Darwin and says, it doesn't have to be that way. We can turn the process upside down. We can have a process of natural selection, which itself has no intelligence, has no foresight. It's completely ignorant in a certain sense. And it just mechanically sifts and sorts and sifts and sorts. It's just a brute mechanical process. And over time, if certain conditions are met, out of this unintelligent process will emerge creation.
But you're saying that what that does, I mean, that notion of Darwinism, it does away with the creator. I mean, there's no place for a creator in Darwin's theory of evolution.
That's right. There is no place for an intelligent creator. The work that an intelligent creator would have to do can be done by the process of natural selection. Our species, Homo sapiens, we're mammals. We're products of evolution, and our brains are material organs. There's no such thing as an immortal soul, as a separate immaterial entity. That's a fragile myth that science can't support at all.
You're saying if you accept evolution by natural selection, the soul goes out the window, because there's no way to account for the evolution of the soul.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Or let me put it slightly differently, because my own work, of course, on consciousness and the brain has particularly dealt with this problem. And an Italian journalist interviewed me, and the paper ran a wonderful headline, "Yes, we have a soul, but it's made of lots of tiny robots." And I thought, that's brilliant. That's exactly my position. Yeah, we do have a soul. That is to say, human beings are different from all other species. We are the moral animal. We are the ones whose minds have the sorts of developments, the sorts of complexities that make us morally responsible in a way that no dog or bear or chimpanzee or dolphin even is responsible. But this is itself a perfectly natural phenomenon. It evolved. We can explain it evolutionarily.
Why is evolution the hot spot in the science and religion debate? I mean, why doesn't quantum physics inspire this kind of controversy, or artificial intelligence?
It's interesting. I think that artificial intelligence would inspire very much the same anger, and in some quarters it does. It's just not well enough known or believed in. But why has this confrontation over evolution not died away a long time ago? I don't think I know. I don't think anybody knows. It's a bit of a scandal that we don't know why creationism should maintain its popularity in the face of 150 years of just stunningly successful biology. And yet the hostility and the ignorance of evolutionary biology is just breathtaking, and it's spreading.
Philosopher Daniel Dennett speaking with Steve Paulson. His latest book is called Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon.
I don't believe that we actually descended from apes.
I do not believe that in any way, shape, or form we descended from apes.
I didn't believe that till I met my uncle who had more back hair than I have facial hair, so yeah, I kind of believe that now.
That's a scene from the documentary film Flock of Dodos. The man who made the film, Randy Olson, has a few thoughts on why evolutionary thinking has run into so much resistance. He says it's because of the arrogance of scientists. Now, I should point out that Olson is himself a scientist, a Harvard-trained evolutionary biologist who's firmly in the camp of evolutionary theory. But his film ridicules the condescending attitude of scientists. It also attacks the intelligent design movement, which Olson says is riddled with contradictions.
The Mount Rushmore example that they use, they don't explain very well at times. And in fact, even in the film, Michael Behe, who's one of the main guys using that, I let him explain it. He didn't do a very good job. I went ahead and put it in there so people can see how confusing this stuff is.
If you're walking by the Rocky Mountains and somebody asked you how they got there, you'd probably just say plate tectonics or erosion or some such thing. But if you walked by Mount Rushmore and somebody asked you how that got there, you'd immediately say, well, somebody carved that. You can, by the physical features of the mountain, you can detect the effects of intelligent activity. Intelligent design is the idea these days that we can detect the effects of intelligence in life. In effect, we see Mount Rushmores in the cell.
But the idea there is that a natural mountainside, you don't see the presence of a hand at work designing it. In Mount Rushmore, suddenly you can see there is this pattern there that you can recognize. But again, it's based on our human preconceptions, and that's why I ended up with that Dover school board member as he was trying to run through Behe's presentation, and I just kept saying to him, yeah, but this is a human designer at work. You've got this hypothesis of what design looks like based on your concepts of what humans make when they make designs. Had Mount Rushmore been carved in the shape of some sort of Precambrian gelatinous organisms that we don't normally recognize, it could very well have been designed, but you'd look at it and think, well, that's not design because it doesn't look like any creature that I know.
Well, this actually raises the other interesting point. You call your film The Flock of Dodos, and it isn't entirely clear who you mean when you're talking about that. It's not necessarily the intelligent design people, because they come off in many ways as having a strong grasp of public relations. Scientists, in your film and others, don't seem to have this same easy grasp of public relations. Is it really just that simple that scientists don't know how to tell people what they know?
Okay, 3 points relevant to this. Number one, I used to be a scientist. I got tenure as a professor at the University of New Hampshire. I used to be an academic, and I used to walk around looking at people saying, you're all stupid. And I know what that perspective is like as an academic. Then I changed my life. I moved to Hollywood, and I ended up in a 2-year acting program. And one of the things, the fundamental rules we learned in that acting program was never rise above. Whenever you rise above in any given scene, the audience will always sympathize with the person being risen above. That was ground in our heads so solidly as one of the firm basic principles of acting. And then a year ago, as I began reading about this intelligent design issue and seeing some of these blog posts where these evolutionists get on these blogs, and I mean, they're still even doing it to me. Evolutionists are writing me emails about how stupid I am with this movie, that I don't understand how this stuff works. And it's really a human constraint of academics. They get so caught up in their perspective that they develop this kind of intolerance and rising above. And that's a symptom that I saw. And I just know, as a basic fundamental principle of communication, it is not effective. And it's gone on in a lot of places. And it's gone on in Kansas, where a lot of the best evolutionists have shown up there and condescended to the general public about, you people are so stupid with all your crazy ideas here. And it's just not that simple.
Well, of course, you showed some of that off in the poker game that recurs throughout the film. There are a number of academics who get together, clearly very bright men, and also clearly people that you'd probably like. But there was a fair amount of arrogance there as well.
Absolutely, and the arrogance was all eight members of the poker game, including myself. I mean, that is a bunch of academics for you.
This is a big controversy, because some people think the Earth was created 6,000 years ago, contrary to all the physical and geological evidence. And because a small number of people who, frankly, are yahoos, who know nothing, are ignoramuses, they really do not understand modern science. Because of that, public education is interfered with. Now, one should never mock people's religious beliefs, and I certainly don't believe in doing that. It's not my position to persuade people you shouldn't believe in God or you should believe in God. But when they come into the scientific arena and they start saying things that are manifestly wrong, that are manifestly ignorant, I think people have to stand up and say, you know, you're an idiot.
The poker game ends up being the most wonderful part of the whole film. I didn't anticipate that that attitude would arise from the thing. But a lot of that attitude is not even so much what is said during the poker game. It's how it's being said. It's the tone of voice. It's the style. It's the whole condescension of all of the people at the table. And it's very characteristic of the situation, the plight of academics today.
One of the things that's clear about your filmmaking style is that you enjoy laughing. It's pretty funny on all sides of this. And I gather you felt it was pretty important to use humor in dealing with a serious subject.
Well, if you watch the film, you'll see that the number one star of the whole film is my mother, Muffy Moose. And in so many of the screenings, people have stood up afterwards and just said, you know, I just want to say the best character in your film is your mother. And it is true. She is a very broad-minded person. One of the things I've come to realize is there are three voices in the film. There is the intelligent designers, there's the evolutionists, and then there's Muffy Moose, who really is the voice of the broad, only semi-interested and enlightened general public. And she's the one that most people seem to connect with in the broader audience. But what's also fascinating that dawned on us just a few weeks ago is that of those three voices, only one of them is searching. The evolutionists feel they've got it all figured out. The intelligent designers feel they've got it all figured out. And all my mother keeps saying through the movie is, I have no idea what's going on. I'm still searching. I'm looking into witchcraft and UFOs and all these other sorts of crazy things, and I'm just looking for some answers. And I think that's one thing that people connect with also with her a lot. And it, of course, at the end of the film, she reveals that her newest interest is Buddhism. So she is constantly exploring, and I think a lot of people admire that.
I'm kind of thinking about studying Buddhism now, because, you know, they believe in these things and they have a great philosophy. They have a happy philosophy. They probably have the happiest philosophy I've heard yet. So I might do a little studying on that one.
Why do you believe it?
Well, I like what they're saying about look forward to the next life. Don't agonize over death. You know, come on, let's get with the program. The flower blooms, lives, and dies, and then goes on. Where does it go? Well, I think they have a nice theory. It goes on to have another life.
A scene from the documentary film Flock of Dodos. I talked with the film's creator, evolutionary biologist Randy Olson. Is evolution compatible with faith in God? The question's been debated ever since Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species in 1859, and it may be the only point that today's creationists and atheists agree on. Both say evolution leaves no room for God. But what did Darwin himself think? To find out, Steve Paulson talked with some leading Darwin experts and made his own pilgrimage to see Darwin's letters at Cambridge University in England.
Charles Darwin not only made one of history's great discoveries, he underwent his own dramatic struggle with faith. Like many proper Victorians, Darwin grew up a devout Anglican, but by the end of his life he'd come to call himself an agnostic. What caused this transformation isn't entirely clear, though his faith started to slip during his long voyage on board the Beagle.
Darwin departed England, a devout Bible literalist.
The eminent biologist Edward O. Wilson, who recently put out a new edition of Darwin's major books.
He had, in fact, trained as a minister at Cambridge University. And as he says in his autobiography, he even would pull out the Bible to settle some argument or try to settle it with other members of the ship's crew, and that they laughed at him because he would quote the Bible.
What happened in the 1830s, when he was in his 20s, he did spend 5 years on board HMS Beagle going round the world.
Philosopher of science Michael Ruse.
And it's pretty clear that during that time, his Christian faith started to fade. So at that point, he didn't believe that Jesus was the Son of God. He became what we call in the trade a deist.
There are various theories on why Darwin rejected Christianity. Years later, Darwin said his voyage on the Beagle exposed him to different religions around the world, and he came to think the biblical stories were not infallible. Biographers have also pointed to a more personal trauma, the death of Darwin's favorite daughter. How could a benevolent God permit such evil? But E.O. Wilson says there was an even more powerful reason Darwin abandoned God.
What really turned him against religion was the doctrine of damnation. He said, if the Bible is true, and you must be redeemed in Christ and be a believer in order to go to heaven and not go to hell, and others will be condemned. And he said, that includes my brothers and all my best friends. And he said, that is a damnable doctrine.
Now, it's worth pointing out that Darwin's discovery of evolution is not what turned him against religion. In fact, it's not clear that Darwin ever thought his theory of natural selection was incompatible with belief in God. But that's not the story we've heard about the origin of species.
The prevailing view is that it was a work which undermined the foundations of religious belief, and that it led to a storm of controversy in which people were divided either for or against, that it was therefore an essentially atheistic tract. And what we found through the correspondence is that there's really a much more complicated story.
That's Paul White, an editor of the Darwin Correspondence Project in England, the massive undertaking, now in its 32nd year, to collect all the letters ever written by and to Darwin. If you want to know what Darwin really thought about religion, this is the place to go. Darwin was always reluctant to say much about religion in his books, but in his letters he let down his guard every so often. Darwin's letters are among the most treasured documents in the Cambridge University Library. They are kept under lock and key. Paul White takes me into a private room where he's laid out some pivotal documents for me to see, books that Darwin owned, with his own notes scribbled in the margins, and letters written to Darwin asking if you could still be a Christian if you believed his theory of evolution.
That's from a woman who was the wife of the mathematician George Boole. She was an educator. She was a writer on religious and philosophical topics. She was also the mother of four children. And she's writing this as a widow. And she's asking for Darwin's frank opinion on certain religious questions, which are troubling her because of her position as a mother. She's never written to Darwin before. He doesn't know who she is. She says, "Will you excuse my venturing to ask you a question which no one's answer but your own would be quite satisfactory to you?" It's actually a series of questions. Do you consider the holding of your theory of natural selection to be inconsistent with the following belief, that knowledge is given to man by the direct inspiration of the Spirit of God, that God is a personal and infinitely good being? And she says, "The reason why I ask you is, my own impression has always been that your theory was quite compatible with the faith to which I have just tried to give expression."
So what does Darwin say in response?
He's a very polite man. He says, "It would have gratified me much if I could have sent satisfactory answers to your questions, or indeed answers of any kind, but I cannot see how the belief that all organic beings, including man, have been genetically derived from some simple being bears on your difficulties. These, as it seems to me, can only be answered by widely different evidence from science or by the so-called inner consciousness." So he's drawing clear boundaries between science and religion. From that sort of letter, it's not at all clear what Darwin personally believed, and he's very reluctant to offer his personal beliefs as a kind of model or standard by which others should live.
What's striking about this correspondence is how much his contemporaries wanted to hear directly from Darwin. There's a sense of scriptural authority. Let's hear it from the great man himself, not unlike the authority of religious texts. Not surprisingly, Darwin was asked if he was an atheist.
Well, here's what he says to an author and philosopher, John Fordyce, in 1879. "In my most extreme fluctuations, I have never been an atheist in the sense of denying the existence of a God. I think that generally, and more so as I grow older, but not always, that An agnostic would be the most correct description of my state of mind. And there are various meanings. Some people try to turn agnosticism into a religion as well, a kind of, you know, atheism by another name. But I think for Darwin, it was very much a sort of statement about his own uncertainty.
So it sounds like Darwin himself left this question entirely unresolved. I mean, it sounds like he was still wrestling with the question of God in his own life, and also the question of, does the theory of evolution displace religion? He's basically saying no.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, that's what he tells his correspondents, and that's perhaps why he wasn't able to investigate it himself. I think if he thought those answers could be discovered through science, he would have taken them on.
That's Paul White of the Darwin Correspondence Project talking with Steve Paulson at Cambridge University Library in England.
In my lifetime, I went from an Eisenhower to a George W. Bush. I went from a John Kennedy to an Albert Gore. Now, if that is evolution, then I believe in about 12 years, we're going to be voting for plants. I have one I'm going to run. President Phil O'Dendron.
Comedian Lewis Black. Want more on the science and religion debate? Go to our website at ttbook.org/God. And while you're there, send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Coming up, atheist Richard Dawkins and creationist Paul Nelson. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called Debating Darwin. It's part of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
When I think of evolution, I think of something that man has come up with. The Big Bang Theory is something that I do not believe in. I believe God's spoken word created the world, the heavens, the earth. It says that He formed it, and it happened in 7 days.
There's scientific evidence that certain creatures have evolved, and it's hard to separate that from just everything was created in 7 days. Because it wasn't.
It's the only explanation the atheists have of this beautiful world that surrounds us. They paint, they disguise it as a scientific thing, which is not. And it's a big lie, it's a big blunder.
It's been proven, we can look at it, we have the science for it. I think it's very frightening for a lot of people to think that we aren't the be-all and end-all.
Our material existence could easily have been caused through evolution, through the Big Bang, let's say, and through the evolution of the universe. But then he uniquely ensouled us. And science cannot speak to the ensoulment of the human person because science can only measure the tangible, and the soul is intangible.
It's human nature to wonder. Some people want the facts, and some people just want to believe in something else. Everybody needs something to believe, I guess.
More than anyone else, the Oxford scientist Richard Dawkins has emerged as the lightning rod in the debate over evolution. Dawkins is not only a prominent biologist, author of the classic book The Selfish Gene, he's also an outspoken atheist. His manifesto against religion is called the God Delusion. Dawkins believes evolution has shattered the foundation of religious faith. The intelligent design advocate, William Dembski, has actually thanked Dawkins for his militant atheism. In a letter to Dawkins, Dembski wrote, and I'm quoting here, "I want to thank you for being such a wonderful foil for theism and for intelligent design more generally. In fact, I regularly tell my colleagues that you and your work are one of God's greatest gifts to the intelligent design movement. So please, keep at it." Steve Paulson wanted to know, how does Dawkins respond to that?
Yeah, I get that quite a lot. In the book, in The God Delusion, I go into this a good deal because it is a very difficult political dilemma that we face. In the United States of America at the moment, science is definitely under attack, and evolution is in the frontline trench of that battle. And so a science defense lobby has sprung up, which in practice largely means an evolution defense lobby. Now, it is true that if you want to win a court case in the United States, where it's specifically on the narrow issue of should evolution be taught in the public schools, if somebody like me is called as a witness and the lawyer for the other side says something like, "Professor Dawkins, is it true that you were led to atheism through your study of Darwinian evolution?" I would have to answer yes. And that, of course, plays into their hands because any jury is likely to have been brought up to believe that atheists are the devil incarnate. And therefore, if Darwinism leads to atheism, then obviously we've got to throw out Darwinism. Well, that is exactly what Dembski, whom you quote, is getting at. He claims to like the things that I say because I am playing into his hands by allowing people like him to make the equation between Darwinism and atheism.
But it's not just Dembski. So I've heard this from various scientists. I mean, hardcore evolutionists who wish you would tone down your rhetoric, quite frankly. I mean, they say,
this
hurts the cause of teaching evolution. Yeah. It just gives fire to the creationists.
Yes. They could be, in a political sense, right. It depends whether you think that the real war is the war over the teaching of evolution, as they do, or whether, as I do, think the real war is between supernaturalism and naturalism, between science and religion. If you think, as I do, that the war is between supernaturalism and naturalism, then the war over the teaching of evolution is just one skirmish, just one battle in the war. So what the scientists that you've been talking to are asking me to do is to shut my mouth, because for the sake of what I see as the war, I'm in danger of losing this particular battle. But as it happens, I think that the war is more important. I actually do care about the existence of a supreme being. I do think it is a scientific question whether the supreme being exists or not. And therefore, I don't think I should say something which I believe to be false, which is that science and religion have no contact with each other. We can all get along cozily together and keep out those lunatic creationists.
Why do you think Darwinian evolution logically leads to atheism?
Well, I'm not sure it's a logical thing. I call it consciousness raising. I think the most powerful reason for believing in a supreme being is the so-called argument from design, or the argument for design. Living things in particular look complicated, look beautiful, look elegant, look as though they've been designed. And therefore, it's really no wonder that before Darwin came along, just about everybody was a theist. What Darwin did was to show that that argument doesn't hold. He blew it out of the water. Darwin destroyed that argument. Although he didn't destroy the parallel argument from, say, cosmology, where did the universe come from, where did the laws of physics come from, he raised our consciousness to the power of science to explain things. So when people say, "I can't see how the universe could have come into being without God," be very careful when you make that kind of argument, because you've had your fingers burned before over biology. That's the consciousness-raising sense in which Darwinism does, I think, lead towards atheism.
Biologist Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion. So, are creationists lunatics, as Dawkins might have us believe? Well, you can judge for yourself. Paul Nelson is a creationist and a fellow at the Discovery Institute. He also has a PhD in the philosophy of science from the University of Chicago.
You know, I don't think I've ever met anyone who holds your view. The occasion was a departmental reception at the University of Chicago in the late 1980s, the sort of event where 20-something graduate students calm their nervous energy with glasses of sherry and try to appear thoughtful. I was speaking with a young woman, a fellow graduate student, whose father was a well-known paleontologist at Berkeley. "So there really are people like you," she said, "creationists." I'm sure I smiled. What else can one do with a statement like that? Still, her remark made me feel odd, as if she had just stumbled across some fabled subspecies of Homo sapiens. The anthropological surprise in her tone was strange, not least because she almost certainly had met someone like me before, even if she grew up in Berkeley. It's a matter of statistics. Surveys consistently show that a majority of Americans doubt Darwinian evolution, the theory of the common descent of life on Earth via undirected mutation and natural selection. Of course, there is regional variation in the acceptance of evolution. Berkeley, Cambridge, Madison, and Seattle are likely to give different numbers than, say, Little Rock, Peoria, or Sioux Falls. But pick 100 Americans at random, put them in a room, and about 70 to 80 people will express skepticism about the theory of evolution. Now, if you're listening to me in Berkeley or Cambridge, you may be shaking your head. Americans, you might say, are badly educated in science. Thus, it's no surprise that when poor science teaching is combined with religious fundamentalism, a lot of our fellow citizens end up rejecting the Darwinian revolution. Let me give you another perspective, however. It isn't really scientific. It's philosophical, and it's probably the deepest question I face. This question, I think, more than any other fact, explains why doubts about Darwinian evolution persist. The question has two parts. Here's the first. Is it possible that an intelligence was involved in the origin and diversification of life on Earth? Here's the second part. If intelligence was involved, shouldn't science be free to investigate that possibility? Notice that religion doesn't play much of a role in this question. What really drives it is wonderment about what might be true. The world of 19th century natural history, Darwin's world, is long gone. Could Darwin have imagined the discoveries that have turned the cell from the largely featureless entity of his time into the complex system of molecular machines we know today? Francis Crick, for many the greatest theoretical biologist of the 20th century, said that biologists must constantly remind themselves that what they see was not designed but evolved. Now, why is that? Why, for instance, does the language of information processing, code, sequence, transcription, translation, fit so naturally with the fundamental patterns of all organisms? How does such information arise? Once questions like these lodge themselves in one's consciousness, along with wonderment about the possibility of intelligent design, the usual answer, namely, leave it to natural selection, rapidly becomes less than satisfying. Natural selection is a real process, to be sure, supported by abundant evidence. But can it do the work of building complex organisms? To ask that question is also to ask for the freedom to seek the answer wherever it may be. That's not religious prejudice. It's basic curiosity. That young woman who was startled by me 20 years ago over Sherry is a professor today. If we met again at a university party, I know how I'd respond. While creationist has become a term of abuse, the idea of creation itself, of a rational and intelligible order rooted in primal intellect, was central to the birth of Western science. For a Christian like me, the river of knowledge called science and the river of understanding called religion have the same source. And thus the responsive joy I have to a scientific discovery is not so very different from that of reading a psalm. In his Religio Medici, Sir Thomas Brown, a contemporary of Newton, wrote, "Nature is the art of God." That's my laptop screensaver. It's also wisdom, from which science has little to fear.
Paul Nelson is a fellow at the Discovery Institute. There's one aspect of evolutionary theory that sticks in the craw of lots of religious believers, the idea that natural selection is a random process, and the evolution of human beings was just a lucky accident. But what if we weren't an accident? What if the evolution of humans, or some intelligent creature very much like us, was inevitable once life first appeared on Earth? Well, that's the view of Cambridge University paleontologist Simon Conway Morris. Now, you may remember his name if you have read Stephen Jay Gould's book, Wonderful Life. Conway Morris was one of Gould's heroes, the young scientist who sifted through the Burgess Shale fossils to help uncover the story of the Cambrian explosion. Since then, he's gone on to argue for what's called convergence, the idea that evolution is actually constrained to move in certain directions. Steve Paulson asked Conway Morris how this applies to the evolution of intelligence.
When we look at the sentience, the intelligence of the most intelligent of the birds in particular, what has turned out to be so fascinating, there's work being done especially on the crows and also on the parrots. They have a mental world which is astonishingly similar to the mental world of the great apes. And of course we are, for all intents and purposes, an ape with a few extra things.
How do we know that their mental world is similar to ours?
Because what one can do is say, well, what are the necessities for complex cognition? And they include such things as imagination. And so if you give many animals a test, they might be good at mazes, for example, but when you give them more difficult things, they're completely stumped. They just don't know how to get around the problem. Whereas if you look at the behavior of jackdaws, especially the crow group as a whole, they're very, very inventive about what they can do, how they can get hold of food. They're also very, very playful. There is a one-to-one correspondence between the different categories of social play and the most intelligent of the birds. I mean, the Kea parrot, for instance, in New Zealand is famous because they're always fooling around and the young go around as delinquent gangs, you know, trashing things. You know, it's a sort of, you know, I don't want to make this too anthropomorphic, but the whole point about these is they clearly live in a rather rich mental world. And I think the really crucial thing about this, the thing which fascinates me more than anything, is not only do we have this match between the mental world of the great apes and some of the birds, but if you look at the structure of the bird brain, it's completely different. It's a brain, to be sure, but apparently, despite these manifest differences, the same sort of mental world emerges. And I think that's convergence. Most people describe it as convergence.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so you've told us that there are lots of different animals that we should probably classify as highly complex, and we could mention others as well, elephants, dolphins, and whales.
Indeed.
That still doesn't make the case that human beings were more or less inevitable.
Well, how does it not, one has to ask. What's, I think, first of all important to stress is that practically everything which makes us human is already present in a nascent form in one or other group of animals. Once you start to take over the world, once you understand the world around you, then my view is all bets are off. And from that perspective, if we're first on the block, fine, but there are many other groups of animals which are really not so far behind.
But aren't human beings here by a massive stroke of luck? I mean, the asteroid that hit the Earth 63 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaurs, and if that asteroid had never hit, wouldn't dinosaurs have continued to dominate the Earth and prevent large mammals from evolving, including humans?
Oh, I think that's absolutely correct. But what I want you to now imagine, in fact, is we've now got to fast forward our conversation by about 30 million years. And I'm afraid I have to tell you the dinosaurs have now disappeared. They've been hunted to extinction. And we're still sitting in the studio and we are using advanced technology.
Who hunted the dinosaurs into extinction?
One or other group of warm-blooded creatures. It could have been the birds, sometimes underestimated, but more likely, I think, the mammals. So the asteroid hits, bang, okay, right, dinosaurs gone, big reptiles gone. Birds and mammals look at each other and say, well, this is a wonderful opportunity, let's evolve. And so we get this dramatic evolutionary explosion, and indeed, here we are. But that asteroid misses. It's a counterfactual history. What's going to happen? Well, my view is, fortunately for us, but unfortunately for the dinosaurs, around about 20 million years after the asteroid missed, the world is actually beginning to get surprisingly cold. We're starting the great ice ages, which culminated in the last 3 or 4 million years. Now, in this counterfactual world, you've got the temperate and the polar regions, which are persistently cold. We've got warm-blooded birds and mammals. We know that birds and mammals, by and large, are more intelligent than the reptiles. We know that they're more socially adept, and we know convergently that they evolve a proto-technology. They're tool makers. So then one says, what's going to happen next? Well, my sense would be that sooner or later, one or other group of hunters is going to emerge. It doesn't have to be exactly the same history as what we had on this planet, but the end result will be the same. What happened when the hunting really got going, especially in North America, is all the big mammals disappeared. And it is generally agreed, though they may not have all been speared to death by Clovis hunters or whatever, when the mass killings begin of the large vertebrates, what would have happened in that counterfactual world would have been that it would have been a Tyrannosaurus going down under a hail of arrows and spears rather than the Mastodon, for instance, in North America.
Well, I want to bring in the religious dimension to some of the things that we've been talking about, because it seems that there are some obvious theological implications to what you've been saying, that evolution moves in a certain direction. You could argue that there is meaning to evolution. There might be purpose to it. Maybe there's even an endpoint. I don't know. And it seems to me there's a lot riding on that question, because from a religious perspective, if you see evolution as just a random accident, it could move in any direction, that would seem very hard to reconcile if you think that we are here for some purpose and we are an expression of God's will.
Well, you could say, is there purpose in the Big Bang? Or is there purpose in galaxies forming? Or is there purpose in a sparrow, for example? I mean, once you start to import these words, unfortunately at the moment, like purpose and also the use of the word design in biology, mm-hmm. there are all sorts of agendas which I myself really find too narrowing and too constricting.
So you're saying a word like purpose is a philosophical word, it's maybe a religious word, but it's not a scientific word.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, the really essential thing to emphasize about science is that you can be honestly wrong. Whereas if you're dealing with your religious faith, such as mine, which is Christian, or anybody else, for instance, who might be a Hindu or Muslim or Jew or any of the other great faiths, will have an entire world picture, which for very many of us which have faith, is a sense that it isn't simply that we are finding ourselves on the edge of a meaningless abyss.
For you, is there a clear dividing line between science and religion?
It has to be for me, because scientists have to retain an objective view of the world. They have to know that they can be always proved wrong. If you don't want to be a scientist, that's absolutely fine. You can be a poet. If you don't want to be a poet and you want to spend a good deal of your time talking to God, then you become a mystic. This world allows poets and mystics and scientists to coexist.
Cambridge University paleontologist Simon Conway Morris talking with Steve Paulson. Conway Morris is the author of the book Life's Solution, Inevitable Humans in a Lonely Universe.
Haven't you ever heard of Darwin? Did you think we were gonna run and hide? Haven't you ever heard of Darwin? Don't roll down your car windows, it's a jungle outside.
I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Debating Darwin, is part of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
I didn't ditch my science at all. It was just a suit too tight fitting, and I had to expand my horizons, expand my worldviews, learn from other cultures.
That's biologist Elizabeth Sartouris, who left her teaching jobs at MIT and the University of Massachusetts, and later her work on the science show Nova, to go live on a Greek island and rethink her life as a scientist. In the years since then, Sartouris has developed a radical critique of Darwinism. I should say, Sartouris has no truck with biblical creationists, but she believes the standard story of evolution has some major problems. And Strainchamps wanted to know more.
Your training is in evolutionary biology, but I know you've come to see the Darwinian account of evolution as not really telling the whole story of our origins. Why do you think the standard story of evolution falls short?
Well, really, this conflict that's going on now between evolution and creationism is a broader battle between science and religion. And that, of course, goes back to when the church in Europe originally was dissatisfied with science because it had a different creation story from the church. However, when the Industrial Revolution comes along, the industrialists can really use the scientists, and so you get a new alliance between science and industry. Now, because of this alliance, Darwin has a kind of different slant on things. In particular, Darwin says in The Origin of Species that his evolutionary theory is the doctrine of Malthus applied to all aspects of nature. Now, Thomas Malthus was the guy who decided the world was going to end soon because human populations always outstrip their food supplies. And he was the chief economist for the first great global multinational, which was the East India Company.
So are you saying that what Darwin came up with is basically an economic model of evolution?
Well, yes. Now, my problem with Darwin is not that it takes an economic view, but that the Malthusian struggle in scarcity story is the only one that Darwin picked up.
But what's wrong with that?
The problem with that is that nature turns out to be extremely intelligent from the get-go, and we now have people studying at the microbiological level and seeing how bacteria, for example, exchange information, make decisions across millions and even billions of individuals in communities so that they can reinvent themselves under stress by literally turning themselves into a different kind of bacterium in a time frame that can't be accounted for by chemical or electrical transmissions of information.
Well, so what do you think is driving this process? Because Darwin suggested that the engine driving all of this is simply accident and random mutation, and then the mutations that work, that are best for the species, are most competitive, are the ones that win out.
Probably the most important driver in evolution is stress. For example, when there's a great extinction on the planet, afterwards you see a flowering of new species that are all in the fossil record at once, as if the planet is, if it could talk about itself, was saying, boy, that didn't work. We couldn't get through that disaster. Let's try something different. The last great extinction killed off the dinosaurs and opened a path for the mammals, which had just begun to come in but weren't getting very far with all those dinosaurs stomping around and chewing them up. So now you get an era of mammalian flowering after that great extinction. And when I talked about the bacteria in the lab in Tel Aviv, they were stressed by putting them, say, on a substrate that they couldn't feed off, and they reinvented themselves. They literally chose from their own gene pool genes that had not been active, turned them into new metabolic cycles so that they could digest something they couldn't previously digest. Now, how did they do that? It happens very, very quickly because the colony dies off pretty immediately if there's no food. And yet it doesn't. It gets resourceful. It gets creative.
I want to talk a little bit more about the connection you make between biology and spirituality, because, you know, science and spirituality have been, we've regarded them as two entirely separate domains for a very long time. But when you write about the origin of the planet, the origin of the cosmos, you very often talk about the planet and the cosmos in terms of consciousness. Can you explain a bit about those ideas?
Yes. Well, when Willis Harmon asked me in the 90s to write a book with him, and we decided to call it Biology Revisioned, he asked me whether I was willing to take consciousness as the source of material evolution rather than as its late emergent product, as most scientists would say, consciousness arising from the brain. And the opposite perspective is the brain arises from consciousness. Now, that's a position that's taken by many of the Eastern philosophies or religions, depending what you call them. For instance, the Vedic, in which consciousness gives rise to the material world. Now, Western science has a foundation made up of unprovable assumptions. And the unproven assumptions of Western science are this is a non-living universe with no purpose, no designer, no intelligence, in which life happens by accidental processes that get more and more complex. So I did make that 180-degree shift, as I call it. What I'm really looking for is an integral global science that would exchange those assumptions about a non-living, purposeless universe For the Vedic assumptions, this would bring East and West together, that the universe begins in a field of consciousness. And of course, the Copenhagen interpretation in physics says that things only happen in reality when our consciousness collapses wave functions. So science is very close to this.
I don't understand why this isn't simply creationism in different garb. I mean, because you're calling it consciousness, but isn't that the same as saying a creationist saying God created the universe?
There's a very big difference between Eastern and Western religions. The Eastern religions do not have a God in the sense of the Western ones, I should call them the desert religions, which is Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. They all have an external creator God who creates the world and then can let it go or manipulate it or whatever, depending on your belief system. In the Eastern, we usually call them philosophies, there is no such personality. There is no external God. God is equivalent to nature. Nature itself is sacred. Nature itself evolves from utter simplicity of oneness to complexity, and you revere it, you commune with it.
But aren't we just quibbling over what you think God is then? I mean, whether God is sort of separate from nature or whether God and nature are the same?
You know, as a scientist, it took me a very long time to be able to say the God word. But what we need is we need to bring East and West together in an integral global science, because this argument between science and religion I see as absolutely unnecessary. We could do the same kind of good technical science research on a foundation of, let's say, the universe is in the business of creating living systems, that it's conscious, that it becomes self-reflective through evolution, and it wouldn't spoil anything in science. What it would help with is questions like, how do you get intelligence out of non-intelligence, out of dumb mud bootstrapping itself? You wouldn't have to answer that question. You wouldn't have to answer where consciousness comes from. And there's no way that humans can ever answer that question. It has to remain a mystery of unity.
Elizabeth Satouris, talking with Anne Strangechamps. Satouris is the author of Earth Dance, Living Systems and Evolution. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called Debating Darwin. It's part of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion. This series was produced by To the Best of Our Knowledge at the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. For more information on To the Best of Our Knowledge or this series, please go to our website at www.ttbook.org/God.
RI, Public Radio International.